of Southeast Asia. Rather, they were all Middle Eastern countries. Palestine, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Syria, and Iran. After that, he turned to Pakistan and Afghanistan. Each time, the Nixon doll screamed out some epithet before dropping the country into his bucket. And in every instance, his vituperative words were anti-Islamic. Muslim dogs, Muhammad's monsters, and Islamic devils. The crowd became very excited, the tension mounting with each new addition to the bucket. They seemed torn between fits of laughter, shock, and rage. At times, I sensed they took offense at the puppeteer's language. I also felt intimidated. I stood out in this crowd, taller than the rest, and I worried that they might direct their anger at me. Then Nixon said something that made my scalp tingle when Rossi translated it. "Give this one to the World Bank. See what it can do to make us some money off Indonesia." He lifted Indonesia from the map and moved to drop it into the bucket. But just at that moment, another puppet leaped out of the shadows. This puppet represented an Indonesian man, dressed in batik shirt and khaki slacks, and he wore a sign with his name clearly printed on it. "A popular Bandung politician," Rossi explained. This puppet literally flew between Nixon and Bucket Man and held up his hand. "Stop!" he shouted. "Indonesia is sovereign!" The crowd burst into applause. Then Bucket Man lifted his flag and thrust it like a spear into the Indonesian, who staggered and died a most dramatic death. The audience members booed, hooted, screamed, and shook their fists. Nixon and Bucket Man stood there, looking out at us. They bowed and left the stage. "I think I should go," I said to Rossi. He placed a hand protectively around my shoulder. "It's okay," he said. "They have nothing against you personally." I wasn't so sure. Later, we all retired to the coffee house. Rossi and the others assured me that they had not been informed ahead of time about the Nixon World Bank skit. "You never know what to expect from that puppeteer," one of the young men observed. I wondered aloud whether this had been staged in my honor. Someone laughed and said I had a very big ego. "Typical of Americans," he added, patting my back congenially. "Indonesians are very conscious of politics," the man in the chair beside me said. "Don't Americans go to shows like this?" A sharp university student, an English major, sat across the table from me. "But you do work for the World Bank, don't you?" she asked. I told her that my current assignment was for the Asian Development Bank and the United States Agency for International Development. "Aren't they really all the same?" She didn't wait for an answer. "Isn't it like the play tonight showed? Doesn't your government look at Indonesia and other countries as though we are just a bunch of..." She searched for the word. "Grapes?" one of her friends coached. "Exactly. A bunch of grapes. You can pick and choose. Keep England, eat China, and throw away Indonesia. After you've taken all our oil," another woman added. I tried to defend myself, but was not at all up to the task. I wanted to take pride in the fact that I had come to this part of town and had stayed to watch the entire anti-U.S. performance, which I might have construed as a personal assault. I wanted them to see the courage of what I had done, wanted them to know that I was the only member of my team who had bothered to learn Bahasa or had any desire to take in their culture, and wanted to point out that I was the sole foreigner attending this production. But I decided it would be more prudent not to mention any of this. Instead, I tried to refocus the conversation. I asked them why they thought the Dalang had singled out Muslim countries, except for Vietnam. The English student laughed at this. "Because that's the plan. Vietnam is just a holding action," one of the men interjected, "like Holland was for the Nazis, a stepping stone. The real target," the woman continued, "is the Muslim world." I could not let this go unanswered. "Surely," I protested, "you can't believe that the United States is anti-Islamic." "Oh, no?" she asked. "Since when?" "You need to read one of your own histories, a Brit named Toynbee. Back in the 50s, he predicted that the real war in the next century would not be between communists and capitalists, but between Christians and Muslims." "Arnold Toynbee said that?" I was stunned. "Yes, read Civilization on Trial and the World and the West. But why should there be such animosity between Muslims and Christians? I asked. Looks were exchanged around the table. They appeared to find it hard to believe that I could ask such a foolish question. Because, she said slowly, as though addressing someone slow-witted or hard of hearing, the West, especially its leader, the U.S., is determined to take control of all the world, to become the greatest empire in history. It has already gotten very close to succeeding. The Soviet Union currently stands in its way, but the Soviets will not endure. Toynbee could see that. They have no religion, no faith, no substance behind their ideology. History demonstrates that faith, soul, a belief in higher powers, is essential. We Muslims have it. We have it more than anyone else in the world, even more than the Christians. So we wait. We grow strong. We will take our time, one of the men chimed in. And then, like a snake, we will strike. What a horrible thought! I could barely contain myself. What can we do to change this? The English major looked me directly in the eyes. Stop being so greedy, she said, and so selfish. Realize that there is more to the world than your big houses and fancy stores. People are starving and you worry about oil for your cars. Babies are dying of thirst and you search the fashion magazines for the latest styles. Nations like ours are drowning in poverty, but your people don't even hear our cries for help. You shut your ears to the voices of those who try to tell you these things. You label them radicals or communists. You must open your hearts to the poor and downtrodden, instead of driving them further into poverty and servitude. There's not much time left. If you don't change, you're doomed. Several days later, the popular Bandung politician, whose puppet stood up to Nixon and was impaled by Bucket Man, was struck and killed by a hit-and-run driver. Soon after that, I headed home. Anne and I met in Paris to attempt a reconciliation. However, we continued to quarrel. On our next to last day, she asked if I'd had an affair. When I confessed, she said she had suspected it all along. We spent many hours sitting on a bench, looking at the Seine and talking. By the time we boarded our flight, we had come to the conclusion that our long history of anger and resentment was too large an obstacle, and that we should live apart. Chapter 9. Opportunity of a Lifetime. Indonesia was a test for me in so many ways, and still more tests awaited me in Boston. I went to the Prudential Center headquarters first thing in the morning, and while I was standing with dozens of other employees at the elevator, I learned that Mac Hall, Maine's enigmatic octogenarian chairman and CEO, had promoted Einar to president of the Portland, Oregon office. As a result, I now officially reported to Bruno Zambadi. Nicknamed the Silver Fox because of the color of his hair and his uncanny ability to outmaneuver everyone who challenged him, Bruno had the dapper good looks of Cary Grant. He was eloquent and held both an engineering degree and an MBA. He understood econometrics and was vice president in charge of Maine's electrical power division and most of our international projects. He also was the obvious choice to take over as president of the corporation when his mentor, the aging Jake Dauber, retired. Like most Maine employees, I was awed and terrified by Bruno Zambadi. Just before lunch, I was summoned to Bruno's office. Following a cordial discussion about Indonesia, he said something that made me jump to the edge of my seat. "I'm firing Howard Parker. We don't need to go into the details, except to say that he's lost touch with reality." His smile was disconcertingly pleasant as he tapped his finger against a sheaf of papers on his desk. 8% a year. That's his load forecast. "Can you believe it? In a country with the potential of Indonesia?" His smile faded, and he looked me squarely in the eye. "Charlie Illingworth tells me that your economic forecast is right on target, and will justify load growth of between 17% and 20%. Is that right?" I assured him it was. He stood up and offered me his hand. "Congratulations. You've just been promoted." Perhaps I should have gone out and celebrated at a fancy restaurant with other Maine employees, or even by myself. However, my mind was on Claudine. I was dying to tell her about my promotion, all my experiences in Indonesia, and my time with Anne. She had warned me not to call her from abroad, and I had not. Now I was dismayed to find that her phone was disconnected, with no forwarding number. I went looking for her. A young couple had moved into her apartment. It was lunchtime, but I believe I roused them from their bed. Obviously annoyed, they professed to know nothing about Claudine. I paid a visit to the real estate agency, pretending to be a cousin. Their files indicated they had never rented to anyone with her name. The previous lease had been issued to a man who would remain anonymous by his request. Back at the Prudential Center, Maine's employment office also claimed to have no record of Claudine. They admitted only to a special consultant's file that was not available for my scrutiny. By late afternoon, I was exhausted and emotionally drained. On top of everything else, a bad case of jet lag had set in. Returning to my empty apartment, I felt desperately lonely and abandoned. My promotion seemed meaningless, or even worse, a badge of my willingness to sell out. I threw myself onto the bed, overwhelmed with despair. I had been used by Claudine and then discarded. Determined not to give in to my anguish, I shut down my emotions. I lay there on my bed, staring at the bare walls for what seemed like hours. Finally, I managed to pull myself together. I got up, swallowed a beer, and smashed the empty bottle against the table. Then I stared out the window. Looking down a distant street, I thought I saw Claudine walking toward me. I started for the door and then returned to the window for another look. The woman had come closer. I could see that she was dressed in that same sophisticated style and that her confident walk was reminiscent of Claudine's. But it was not Claudine. My heart sank, and my feelings changed from anger and loathing to fear. I wondered if she had died or been killed. I took a couple Valium and drank myself to sleep. The next morning, a call from Maine's personnel department woke me from my stupor. Its chief, Paul Mormino, assured me that he understood my need for rest, but he urged me to come in that afternoon. "Good news," he said. "The best thing for catching up with yourself." I obeyed the summons and learned that Bruno had been more than true to his word. I not only had been promoted to Howard's old job, I also had been given the title of chief economist and a raise. It did cheer me up a bit. I took the afternoon off and wandered down along the Charles River with a quart of beer. As I sat there, watching the sailboats and nursing combined jet lag and vicious hangover, I convinced myself that Claudine had done her job and had moved on to her next assignment. She had always emphasized the need for secrecy. She would call me. Mormino had been right. My jet lag and my anxiety dissipated. During the next weeks, I tried to put all thoughts of Claudine aside. I focused on writing my report on the Indonesian economy and on revising Howard's load forecasts. I came up with the type of study my bosses wanted to see, a growth in electric demand averaging 19% per annum for 12 years after the new system was completed, tapering down to 17% for 8 more years, and then holding at 15% for the remainder of the 25-year projection. I presented my conclusions at formal meetings with the international lending agencies. Their teams of experts questioned me extensively and mercilessly. By then, my emotions had turned into a sort of grim determination, not unlike those that had driven me to excel rather than to rebel during my prep school days. Nonetheless, Claudine's memory always hovered close. When a sassy young economist out to make a name for himself at the Asian Development Bank grilled me relentlessly for an entire afternoon, I recalled the advice Claudine had given me as we sat in her Beacon Street apartment those many months before. "Who can see 25 years into the future?" she had asked. "Your guess is as good as theirs. Confidence is everything." I convinced myself I was an expert, reminding myself that I had experienced more of life in economically developing countries than many of the men, some of them twice my age, who now sat in judgment of my work. I had lived in the Amazon and had traveled to parts of Java no one else wanted to visit. I had taken a couple of intensive courses aimed at teaching executives the finer points of econometrics, and I told myself that I was part of the new breed of statistically oriented, econometric-worshipping whiz kids that appealed to Robert McNamara, the button-down president of the World Bank, former president of Ford Motor Company, and John Kennedy's Secretary of Defense. Here was a man who had built his reputation on numbers, on probability theory, on mathematical models, and, I suspected, on the bravado of a very large ego. I tried to emulate both McNamara and my boss, Bruno. I adopted manners of speech that imitated the former, and I took to walking with the swagger of the latter, attaché case swinging at my side. Looking back, I have to wonder at my gall. In truth, my expertise was extremely limited, but what I lacked in training and knowledge I made up for in audacity. And it worked. Eventually, the team of experts stamped my reports with their seals of approval. During the ensuing months, I attended meetings in Tehran, Caracas, Guatemala City, London, Vienna, and Washington, D.C. I met famous personalities, including the Shah of Iran, the former presidents of several countries, and Robert McNamara himself. Like prep school, it was a world of men. I was amazed at how my new title and the accounts of my recent successes before the international lending agencies affected other people's attitudes toward me. At first, all the attention went to my head. I began to think of myself as a Merlin who could wave his wand over a country, causing it suddenly to light up, industries sprouting like flowers. Then I became disillusioned. I questioned my own motives and those of all the people I worked with. It seemed that a glorified title or a PhD did little to help a person understand the plight of a leper living beside a cesspool in Jakarta, and I doubted that a knack for manipulating statistics enabled a person to see into the future. The better I came to know those who made the decisions that shape the world, the more skeptical I became about their abilities and their goals. I doubted whether limited resources would allow the whole world to live the opulent life of the United States, when even the United States had millions of citizens living in poverty. In addition, it wasn't entirely clear to me that people in other nations actually wanted to live like us. Our own statistics about violence, depression, drug abuse, divorce, and crime indicated that although ours was one of the wealthiest societies in history, it might also be one of the least happy societies. Why would we want others to emulate us? Looking at the faces in the meetings I attended, my skepticism often turned to silent anger at the hypocrisy. Eventually, however, this also changed. I came to understand that most of those men believed they were doing the right thing. Like Charlie, they were convinced that communism and terrorism were evil forces, rather than the predictable reactions to decisions they and their predecessors had made, and that they had a duty to their country, to their offspring, and to God to convert the world to capitalism. They also clung to the principle of survival of the fittest. If they happened to enjoy the good fortune to have been born into a privileged class, instead of inside a cardboard shack, then they saw it as an obligation to pass this heritage on to their progeny. I vacillated between viewing such people as an actual conspiracy and simply seeing them as a tight-knit fraternity bent on dominating the world. Nonetheless, over time I began to liken them to the plantation owners of the pre-Civil War South. They were men drawn together in a loose association by common beliefs and shared self-interest, rather than an exclusive group meeting in clandestine hideaways with focused and sinister intent. The plantation autocrats had grown up with servants and slaves, and had been educated to believe that it was their right and even their duty to take care of the heathens and to convert them to the owner's religion and way of life. Even if slavery repulsed them philosophically, they could, like Thomas Jefferson, justify it as a necessity, the collapse of which would result in social and economic chaos. The leaders of the modern oligarchies, what I now thought of as the corporatocracy, seemed to fit the same mold. I also began to wonder who benefits from war and the mass production of weapons, from the damming of rivers and the destruction of indigenous environments and cultures. I began to look at who benefits when hundreds of thousands of people die from insufficient food, polluted water, or curable diseases. Slowly I came to realize that in the long run, no one benefits. But in the short term, those at the top of the pyramid, my bosses and me, appear to benefit, at least materially. This raised several other questions. Why does this situation persist? Why has it endured for so long? Does the answer lie simply in the old adage that might makes right, that those with the power perpetuate the system? It seemed insufficient to say that power alone allows this situation to persist. Although the proposition that might makes right explained a great deal, I felt there must be a more compelling force at work here. I recalled an economics professor from my business school days, a man from northern India, who lectured about limited resources, about man's need to grow continually, and about the principle of slave labor. According to this professor, all successful capitalist systems involve hierarchies with rigid chains of command, including a handful at the very top who control descending orders of subordinates, and a massive army of workers at the bottom, who, in relative economic terms, truly can be classified as slaves. Ultimately, then, I became convinced that we encourage this system, because the corporatocracy has convinced us that God has given us the right to place a few of our people at the very top of this capitalist pyramid, and to export our system to the entire world. Of course, we are not the first to do this. The list of practitioners stretches back to the ancient empires of North Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, and works its way up through Persia, Greece, Rome, the Christian Crusades, and all the European empire builders of the post-Columbian era. This imperialist drive has been and continues to be the cause of most wars, pollution, starvation, species extinctions, and genocides. And it has always taken a serious toll on the conscience and well-being of the citizens of those empires, contributing to social malaise and resulting in a situation where the wealthiest cultures in human history are plagued with the highest rates of suicide, drug abuse, and violence. I thought extensively on these questions, but I avoided considering the nature of my own role in all of this. I tried to think of myself not as an EHM, but as a chief economist. It sounded so very legitimate, and if I needed any confirmation, I could look at my pay stubs. All were from Maine, a private corporation. I didn't earn a penny from the NSA or any government agency. And so I became convinced. Almost. One afternoon, Bruno called me into his office. He walked behind my chair and patted me on the shoulder. "You've done an excellent job," he purred. "To show our appreciation, we're giving you the opportunity of a lifetime, something few men ever receive, even at twice your age." Chapter 10. Panama's President and Hero. I landed at Panama's Tucumán International Airport late one night in April 1972, during a tropical deluge. As was common in those days, I shared a taxi with several other executives, and because I spoke Spanish, I ended up in the front seat beside the driver. I stared blankly out the taxi's windshield. Through the rain, the headlights illuminated a billboard portrait of a handsome man with a prominent brow and flashing eyes. One side of his wide-brimmed hat was hooked rakishly up. I recognized him as the hero of modern Panama, Omar Torrijos. I had prepared for this trip in my customary fashion, by visiting the reference section of the Boston Public Library. I knew that one of the reasons for Torrijos's popularity among his people was that he was a firm defender of both Panama's right of self-rule and its claims to sovereignty over the Panama Canal. He was determined that the country under his leadership would avoid the pitfalls of its ignominious history. Panama was part of Colombia when the French engineer Ferdinand de Lesseps, who had directed construction of the Suez Canal, decided to build a canal through the Central American Isthmus to connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Beginning in 1881, the French undertook a mammoth effort that met with one catastrophe after another. Finally, in 1889, the project ended in financial disaster. But it had inspired a dream in Theodore Roosevelt. During the first years of the 20th century, the United States demanded that Colombia sign a treaty turning the isthmus over to a North American consortium. Colombia refused. In 1903, President Roosevelt sent in the U.S. warship Nashville. U.S. soldiers landed, seized and killed a popular local militia commander, and declared Panama an independent nation. A puppet government was installed, and the first canal treaty was signed. It established an American zone on both sides of the future waterway, legalized U.S. military intervention, and gave Washington virtual control over this newly formed independent nation. Interestingly, the treaty was signed by U.S. Secretary of State John Hay and a French engineer, Philippe Bouneau-Varilla, who had been part of the original team, but it was not signed by a single Panamanian. In essence, Panama was forced to leave Colombia in order to serve the United States, in a deal struck by an American and a Frenchman. In retrospect, a prophetic beginning. For more than half a century, Panama was ruled by an oligarchy of wealthy families with strong connections to Washington. They were right-wing dictators who took whatever measures they deemed necessary to ensure that their country promoted U.S. interests. In the manner of most of the Latin American dictators who allied themselves with Washington, Panama's rulers interpreted U.S. interests to mean putting down any populist movement that smacked of socialism. They also supported the CIA and NSA in anti-communist activities throughout the hemisphere, and they helped big American businesses like Rockefeller's Standard Oil and United Fruit Company. These governments apparently did not feel that U.S. interests were promoted by improving the lives of people who lived in dire poverty, or served as virtual slaves to the big plantations and corporations. Panama's ruling families were well rewarded for their support. U.S. military forces intervened on their behalf a dozen times between the Declaration of Panamanian Independence and 1968. However, that year, while I was still a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador, the course of Panamanian history suddenly changed. A coup overthrew Arnulfo Arias, the latest in the parade of dictators, and Omar Torrijos emerged as the head of state, although he had not actively participated in the coup. Torrijos was highly regarded by the Panamanian middle and lower classes. He had grown up in the rural city of Santiago, where his parents taught school. He had risen quickly through the ranks of the National Guard, Panama's primary military unit, and an institution that during the 1960s gained increasing support among the poor. Torrijos earned a reputation for listening to the dispossessed. He walked the streets of their shanty towns, held meetings in slums that politicians didn't dare to enter, helped the unemployed find jobs, and often donated his own limited financial resources to families stricken by illness or tragedy. His love of life and his compassion for people reached even beyond Panama's borders. Torrijos was committed to turning his nation into a haven for fugitives from persecution, a place that would offer asylum to refugees from both sides of the political fence, from leftist opponents of Chile's Pinochet to right-wing anti-Castro guerrillas. Many people saw him as an agent of peace, a perception that earned him praise throughout the hemisphere. He also developed a reputation as a leader who was dedicated to resolving differences among the various factions that were tearing apart so many Latin American countries: Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Cuba, Colombia, Peru, Argentina, Chile, and Paraguay. His small nation of 2 million people served as a model of social reform and an inspiration for world leaders as diverse as the labor organizers who plotted the dismemberment of the Soviet Union and Islamic militants like Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. My first night in Panama stopped at the traffic light, peering past the noisy windshield wipers. I was moved by this man smiling down at me from the billboard, handsome, charismatic, and courageous. I knew from my hours at the BPL that he stood behind his beliefs. For the first time in its history, Panama was not a puppet of Washington or of anyone else. Torrijos never succumbed to the temptations offered by Moscow or Beijing. He believed in social reform and in helping those born into poverty. But he did not advocate communism. Unlike Castro, Torrijos was determined to win freedom from the United States without forging alliances with the United States' enemies. I had stumbled across an article in some obscure journal in the BPL racks that praised Torrijos as a man who would alter the history of the Americas, reversing a long-term trend toward U.S. domination. The author cited as his starting point Manifest Destiny, the doctrine popular with many Americans during the 1840s. that the conquest of North America was divinely ordained, that God, not men, had ordered the genocide of native North Americans, the destruction of forests, the near extinction of buffalo, the draining of swamps, the rechanneling of rivers, and the development of an economy that depends on the continuing exploitation of labor and natural resources. The article got me thinking about my country's attitude toward the world. The Monroe Doctrine, originally enunciated by President James Monroe in 1823, was used to take Manifest Destiny a step further when, in the 1850s and 1860s, it was used to assert that the United States had special rights all over the hemisphere, including the right to invade any nation in Central or South America that refused to back U.S. policies. Teddy Roosevelt invoked the Monroe Doctrine to justify U.S. intervention in the Dominican Republic, in Venezuela, and during the liberation of Panama from Colombia. A string of subsequent U.S. presidents, most notably Taft, Wilson, and Franklin Roosevelt, relied on it to expand Washington's Pan-American activities through the end of World War II. Finally, during the latter half of the 20th century, the United States used the communist threat to justify expansion of this concept to countries around the globe, including Vietnam and Indonesia. Now it seemed one man was standing in Washington's way. I knew that he was not the first. Leaders like Castro and Allende had gone before him. But Torrijos alone was doing it outside the realm of communist ideology, and without claiming that his movement was a revolution. He was simply saying that Panama had its own rights, to sovereignty over its people, its lands, and a waterway that bisected it, and that these rights were as valid and as divinely bestowed as any enjoyed by the United States. Torrijos also objected to the School of the Americas, renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation in 2001, and to the U.S. Southern Command's Tropical Warfare Training Center, both located in the Canal Zone. For years, the United States Armed Forces had invited Latin American dictators and presidents to send their sons and military leaders to these facilities, the largest and best equipped outside North America. There they learned interrogation and covert operational skills, as well as military tactics that they would use to fight communism and to protect their own assets and those of the oil companies and other private corporations. They also had opportunities to bond with the United States' top brass. These facilities were hated by Latin Americans, except for the few wealthy ones who benefited from them. They were known to provide schooling for right-wing death squads and the torturers who had turned so many nations into totalitarian regimes. Torrijos made it clear that he did not want training centers located in Panama, and that he considered the Canal Zone to be included within his borders. Seeing the handsome general on the billboard and reading the caption beneath his face, "Omar's ideal is freedom. The missile is not invented that can kill an ideal," I felt a shiver run down my spine. I had a premonition that the story of Panama in the 20th century was far from over, and that Torrijos was in for a difficult, and perhaps even tragic, time. The tropical storm battered the windshield, the traffic light turned green, and the driver honked his horn at the car ahead of us. I thought about my own position. I had been sent to Panama to close the deal on what would become Maine's first truly comprehensive master development plan. This plan would create a justification for World Bank, Inter-American Development Bank, and USAID investment of billions of dollars in the energy, transportation, and agriculture sectors of this tiny and very crucial country. It was, of course, a subterfuge, a means of making Panama forever indebted and thereby returning it to its puppet status. As the taxi started to move through the night, a paroxysm of guilt flashed through me. But I suppressed it. What did I care? I had taken the plunge in Java, sold my soul, and now I could create my opportunity of a lifetime. I could become rich, famous, and powerful in one blow. Chapter 11. Pirates in the Canal Zone. The next day, the Panamanian government sent a man to show me around. His name was Fidel, and I was immediately drawn to him. He was tall and slim, and took an obvious pride in his country. His great-great-grandfather had fought beside Bolivar to win independence from Spain. I told him I was related to Tom Paine, and I was thrilled to learn that Fidel had read Common Sense in Spanish. He spoke English, but when he discovered I was fluent in the language of his country, he was overcome with emotion. "Many of your people live here for years and never bother to learn it," he said. Fidel took me on a drive through an impressively prosperous sector of his city, which he called the New Panama. As we passed modern glass and steel skyscrapers, he explained that Panama had more international banks than any other country south of the Rio Grande. "We're often called the Switzerland of the Americas," he said. "We ask very few questions of our clients." Late in the afternoon, with the sun sliding toward the Pacific, we headed out on an avenue that followed the contours of the bay. A long line of ships was anchored there. I asked Fidel whether there was a problem with the canal.
"It's always like this," he replied with a laugh. "Lines of them, waiting their turn. Half the traffic is coming from or going to Japan, more even than the United States."
I confessed that this was news to me.
"I'm not surprised," he said.
"North Americans don't know much about the rest of the world." We stopped at a beautiful park in which bougainvillea crept over ancient ruins. A sign proclaimed that this was a fort built to protect the city against marauding English pirates. A family was setting up for an evening picnic, a father, mother, son, and daughter, and an elderly man who I assumed was the children's grandfather. I felt a sudden longing for the tranquility that seemed to embrace these five people. As we passed them, the couple smiled, waved, and greeted us in English. I asked if they were tourists, and they laughed. The man came over to us.
"I'm third generation in the canal zone," he explained proudly. "My granddad came 3 years after it was created. He drove one of the mules, the tractors that hauled ships through the locks."
He pointed at the elderly man, who was preoccupied helping the children set the picnic table.
"My dad was an engineer, and I've followed in his footsteps."
The woman had returned to helping her father-in-law and children. Beyond them, the sun dipped into the blue water. It was a scene of idyllic beauty, reminiscent of a Monet painting. I asked the man if they were U.S. citizens. He looked at me incredulously.
"Of course, the canal zone is U.S. territory."
The boy ran up to tell his father that dinner was ready.
"Will your son be the fourth generation?"
The man brought his hands together in a sign of prayer and raised them toward the sky.
"I pray to the good Lord every day that he may have that opportunity. Living in the zone is a wonderful life."
Then he lowered his hands and stared directly at Fidel.
"I just hope we can hold on to her for another 50 years. That despot Torrijos is making a lot of waves. A dangerous man."
A sudden urge gripped me, and I said to him in Spanish,
"Adios. I hope you and your family have a good time here and learn lots about Panama's culture."
He gave me a disgusted look.
"I don't speak their language," he said.
Then he turned abruptly and headed toward his family and the picnic. Fidel stepped close to me, placed an arm around my shoulders, and squeezed tightly.
"Thank you," he said.
Back in the city, Fidel drove us through an area he described as a slum.
"Not our worst," he said, "but you'll get the flavor."
Wooden shacks and ditches filled with standing water lined the street, the frail homes suggesting dilapidated boats scuttled in a cesspool. The smell of rot and sewage filled our car as children with distended bellies ran alongside. When we slowed, they congregated at my side, calling me uncle and begging for money. It reminded me of Jakarta. Graffiti covered many of the walls. There were a few of the usual hearts with couples' names scrawled inside, but most of the graffiti comprised slogans expressing hatred of the United States.
"Go home, gringo. Stop shitting in our canal. Uncle Sam, slave master." And, "Tell Nixon that Panama is not Vietnam."
The one that chilled my heart the most, however, read, "Death for freedom is the way to Christ." Scattered among these were posters of Omar Torrijos.
"Now the other side," Fidel said. "I've got official papers and you're a U.S. citizen, so we can go."
Beneath a magenta sky, he drove us into the canal zone. As prepared as I thought I was, it was not enough. I could hardly believe the opulence of the place,
Huge white buildings, manicured lawns, plush homes, golf courses, stores, and theaters. "The facts," he said. "Everything here is U.S. property. All the businesses, the supermarkets, barbershops, beauty salons, restaurants, all of them, are exempt from Panamanian laws and taxes. There are 7 18-hole golf courses, U.S. post offices scattered conveniently around, U.S. courts of law and schools. It truly is a country within a country." Fidel peered at me. "Over there," he pointed back toward the city, "income per capita is less than $1,000 a year, and unemployment rates are 30%. Of course, in the little shanty town we just visited, no one makes close to $1,000, and hardly anyone has a job. What's being done?" He turned and gave me a look that seemed to change from anger to sadness. "What can we do?" He shook his head. "I don't know. But I'll say this. Torrijos is trying. I think it may be the death of him, but he sure as hell is giving it all he's got. He's a man who'll go down fighting for his people." As we headed out of the canal zone, Fidel smiled. "You like to dance?" Without waiting for me to reply, he said, "Let's get some dinner, and then I'll show you yet another side of Panama." Chapter 12. Soldiers and Prostitutes. After a juicy steak and a cold beer, we left the restaurant and drove down a dark street. Fidel advised me never to walk in this area. "When you come here, take a cab right to the front door," he pointed. "Just there, beyond the fence, is the canal zone." He drove on until we arrived at a vacant lot filled with cars. He found an empty spot and parked. An old man hobbled up to us. Fidel got out and patted him on the back. Then he ran his hand lovingly across the fender of his car. "Take good care of her. She's my lady." He handed the man a bill. We took a short footpath out of the parking lot and suddenly found ourselves on a street flooded with flashing neon lights. Two boys raced past. The one behind, the larger of the two, was pointing a stick at the other and making the sounds of a man shooting a gun. The smaller one slammed into Fidel's legs, his head reaching barely as high as Fidel's thigh. He stepped back. "I'm sorry, sir," he gasped in Spanish. Fidel placed both his hands on the boy's shoulders. "No harm done, my man," he said. "But tell me, why was your friend shooting at you?" The other boy came up to us. He placed his arm protectively around the first. "My brother," he explained. "We're sorry." "It's okay," Fidel chuckled gently. "He didn't hurt me. I just asked him why you were shooting at him." The brothers glanced at each other. The older one smiled. "He's the gringo general at the canal zone. He tried to rape our mother, and I'm sending him packing, back to where he belongs." Fidel stole a look at me. "Where does he belong?" "At home, in the United States." "Does your mother work here?" "Over there." Both boys pointed proudly at a neon light down the street. "Bartender." "Go on, then." Fidel handed them each a coin. "But be careful. Stay in the lights." "Oh, yes, sir. Thank you." They raced off. As we walked on, Fidel explained that Panamanian women were prohibited by law from prostitution. They can tend bar and dance, but they cannot sell their bodies. That's left to the imports. We stepped inside the bar and were blasted with a popular American song. My eyes and ears took a moment to adjust. A couple of burly U.S. soldiers stood near the door. Bands around their uniformed arms identified them as military police. Fidel led me along a bar, and then I saw the stage. Three young women were dancing there, entirely naked except for their heads. One wore a sailor's cap, another a green beret, and the third a cowboy hat. They were laughing. They seemed to be playing a game with one another, as though dancing in a competition. The music, the way they danced, the stage. It could have been a disco in Boston, except that they were naked. We pushed our way through a group of young English-speaking men. Although they wore t-shirts and blue jeans, their crew cuts gave them away as soldiers from the Canal Zone's military base. Fidel tapped a waitress on the shoulder. She turned, let out a scream of delight, and threw her arms around him. The group of young men watched this intently, glancing at one another with disapproval. I wondered if they thought Manifest Destiny included this Panamanian woman. The waitress led us to a corner. From somewhere, she produced a small table and two chairs. As we settled in, Fidel exchanged greetings in Spanish with two men at a table beside ours. Unlike the soldiers, they wore printed short-sleeved shirts and creased slacks. The waitress returned with a couple of Balboa beers, and Fidel patted her on the rump as she turned to leave. She smiled and threw him a kiss. I glanced around and was relieved to discover that the young men at the bar were no longer watching us. They were focused on the dancers. The majority of the patrons were English-speaking soldiers, but there were others, like the two beside us, who obviously were Panamanians. They stood out because their hair would not have passed inspection, and because they did not wear t-shirts and jeans. A few of them sat at tables, others leaned against the walls. They seemed to be highly alert, like border collies guarding flocks of sheep. Women roamed the tables. They moved constantly, sitting on laps, shouting to the waitresses, dancing, swirling, singing, taking turns on the stage. They wore tight skirts, t-shirts, jeans, clinging dresses, high heels. One was dressed in a Victorian gown and veil. Another wore only a bikini. It was obvious that they had to rely on their beauty to survive here. I marveled at the numbers of displaced women who made their way to Panama, and wondered at the desperation that had driven them to this. "All from other countries?" I shouted to Fidel above the music. He nodded. "Except," he pointed at the waitresses, "they're Panamanian." "What countries are the others from?" "Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala." "Neighbors?" "Not entirely. Costa Rica and Colombia are our closest neighbors." The waitress who had led us to the table came and sat on Fidel's knee. He gently rubbed her back. "Clarissa," he said, "please tell my North American friend why they left their countries." He nodded his head in the direction of the stage. Three new girls were accepting the hats from the others, who jumped down and started dressing. The music switched to salsa, and as the newcomers danced, they shed their clothes to the rhythm. Clarissa held out her right hand. "I'm pleased to meet you," she said. Then she stood up and reached for our empty bottles. "In answer to Fidel's question, these girls come here to escape even worse brutality. I'll bring a couple more Balboas." After she left, I turned to Fidel. "Come on," I said. "They're here for U.S. dollars." "True, but why so many from the countries where fascist dictators rule?" I glanced back at the stage. The three of them were giggling and throwing the sailor's cap around like a ball. I looked Fidel in the eye. "You're not kidding, are you?" "No," he said seriously. "I wish I were. Most of these girls have lost their families. Fathers, brothers, husbands, boyfriends. They grew up with torture and death. Most of them are single mothers. Dancing and prostitution seem their only options. They can make a lot of money here. Then start fresh somewhere. Buy a little shop, open a cafe." He was interrupted by a commotion near the bar. I saw a waitress swing her fist at one of the soldiers, who caught her hand and began to twist her wrist. She screamed and fell to her knee. He laughed and shouted to his buddies. They all laughed. She tried to hit him with her free hand. He twisted harder. Her face contorted with pain. The MPs remained by the door, watching calmly. Fidel jumped to his feet and started toward the bar. One of the men at the table next to ours held out a hand to stop him. "Tranquillo, hermano," he said. "Be calm, brother. Enrique has control." A tall, slim Panamanian came out of the shadows near the stage. He moved like a cat and was upon the soldier in an instant. One hand encircled the soldier's throat while the other doused him in the face with a glass of water. The waitress slipped away. Several of the Panamanians who had been lounging against the walls formed a protective semicircle around the tall bouncer. He lifted the soldier against the bar and said something I couldn't hear. Then he raised his voice and spoke slowly in English, loudly enough for everyone in the still room to hear over the music. "The waitresses are off limits to you guys, and you don't touch the others until after you pay them." The two MPs finally swung into action. They approached the cluster of Panamanians. "We'll take it from here, Enrique," they said. The bouncer lowered the soldier to the floor, and gave his neck a final squeeze, forcing the other's head back and eliciting a cry of pain. "Do you understand me?" There was a feeble groan. "Good." He pushed the soldier at the two MPs. "Get him out of here." Chapter 13. Conversations with the General. The invitation was completely unexpected. One morning during that same 1972 visit, I was sitting in an office I had been given at the Instituto de Recursos Hidrólicos de Electrificación, Panama's government-owned electricity utility company. I was poring over a sheet of statistics when a man knocked gently on the frame of my open door. I invited him in, pleased with any excuse to take my attention off the numbers. He announced himself as the general's chauffeur and said he had come to take me to one of the general's bungalows. An hour later, I was sitting across the table from General Omar Torrijos. He was dressed casually in typical Panamanian style, khaki slacks and a short-sleeved shirt buttoned down the front, light blue with a delicate green pattern. He was tall, fit, and handsome. He seemed amazingly relaxed for a man with his responsibilities. A lock of dark hair fell over his prominent forehead. He asked about my recent travels to Indonesia, Guatemala, and Iran. The three countries fascinated him, but he seemed especially intrigued with Iran's king, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi. The Shah had come into power in 1941, after the British and Soviets overthrew his father, whom they accused of collaborating with Hitler. "Can you imagine," Torrijos asked, "being part of a plot to dethrone your own father?" Panama's head of state knew a good deal about the history of this far-off land. We talked about how the tables were turned on the Shah in 1951, and how his own premier, Mohammad Mossadegh, forced him into exile. Torrijos knew, as did most of the world, that it had been the CIA that labeled the premier a communist and stepped in to restore the Shah to power. However, he did not know, or at least did not mention, the parts Claudine had shared with me about Kermit Roosevelt's brilliant maneuvers and the fact that this had been the beginning of a new era in imperialism, the match that had ignited the global empire conflagration. After the Shah was reinstated, Torrijos continued, he launched a series of revolutionary programs aimed at developing the industrial sector and bringing Iran into the modern era. I asked him how he happened to know so much about Iran. "I make it my point," he said. "I don't think too highly of the Shah's politics, his willingness to overthrow his own father and become a CIA puppet. But it looks as though he's doing good things for his country. Perhaps I can learn something from him, if he survives." "You think he won't?" "He has powerful enemies, and some of the world's best bodyguards." Torrijos gave me a sardonic look. "His secret police, SAVAK, have the reputation of being ruthless thugs. That doesn't win many friends. He won't last much longer." He paused, then rolled his eyes. "Bodyguards? I have a few myself." He waved at the door. "You think they'll save my life if your country decides to get rid of me?" I asked whether he truly saw that as a possibility. He raised his eyebrows in a manner that made me feel foolish for asking such a question. "We have the canal. That's a lot bigger than Arbenz and United Fruit." I had researched Guatemala, and I understood Torrijos' meaning. United Fruit Company had been that country's political equivalent of Panama's canal. Founded in the late 1800s, United Fruit soon grew into one of the most powerful forces in Central America. During the early 1950s, reform candidate Jacobo Arbenz was elected president of Guatemala in an election hailed all over the hemisphere as a model of the democratic process. At the time, less than 3% of Guatemalans owned 70% of the land. Arbenz promised to help the poor dig their way out of starvation, and after his election, he implemented a comprehensive land reform program. "The poor and middle classes throughout Latin America applauded Arbenz," Torrijos said. "He was one of my personal heroes. But we also held our breath. We knew that United Fruit opposed these measures, since they were one of the largest and most oppressive landholders in Guatemala. They also owned big plantations in Colombia, Costa Rica, Cuba, Jamaica, Nicaragua, Santo Domingo, and here in Panama. They couldn't afford to let Arbenz give the rest of us ideas." I knew what followed. United Fruit had launched a major public relations campaign in the United States, aimed at convincing the American public and Congress that Arbenz was part of a Russian plot and that Guatemala was a Soviet satellite. In 1954, the CIA orchestrated a coup. American pilots bombed Guatemala City, and the democratically elected Arbenz was overthrown, replaced by Colonel Carlos Castillo Armas, a ruthless right-wing dictator. The new government owed everything to United Fruit. By way of thanks, the government reversed the land reform process, abolished taxes on the interest and dividends paid to foreign investors, eliminated the secret ballot, and jailed thousands of its critics. Anyone who dared to speak out against Castillo was persecuted. Historians trace the violence and terrorism that plagued Guatemala for most of the rest of the century to the not-so-secret alliance between United Fruit, the CIA, and the Guatemalan army under its colonel dictator. Arbenz was assassinated, Torrijos continued. Political and character assassination. He paused and frowned. How could your people swallow that CIA rubbish? I won't go so easily. The military here are my people. Political assassination won't do. He smiled. The CIA itself will have to kill me. We sat in silence for a few moments, each lost in his own thoughts. Torrijos was the first to speak. Do you know who owns United Fruit? He asked. Zapata Oil, George Bush's company, our UN ambassador, I said. A man with ambitions. He leaned forward and lowered his voice. And now I'm up against his cronies at Bechtel. This startled me. Bechtel was the world's most powerful engineering firm, and a frequent collaborator on projects with Maine. In the case of Panama's master plan, I had assumed that they were one of our major competitors. What do you mean? We've been considering building a new canal, a sea-level one, without locks. It can handle bigger ships. The Japanese may be interested in financing it. They're the canal's biggest clients. Exactly. Of course, if they provide the money, they will do the construction. It struck me. Bechtel will be out in the cold. The biggest construction job in recent history. He paused. Bechtel's loaded with Nixon, Ford, and Bush cronies. Bush, as U.S. ambassador to the UN, and Ford, as House Minority Leader and Chairman of the Republican National Convention, were well known to Torrijos as Republican power brokers. I've been told that the Bechtel Company pulls the strings of the Republican Party. This conversation left me feeling very uncomfortable. I was one of the people who perpetuated the system he so despised, and I was certain he knew it. My job of convincing him to accept international loans in exchange for hiring U.S. engineering and construction firms appeared to have hit a mammoth wall. I decided to confront him head-on. General, I asked, why did you invite me here? He glanced at his watch and smiled. Yes, time now to get down to our own business. Panama needs your help. I need your help. I was stunned. My help? What can I do for you? We will take back the canal, but that's not enough. He relaxed into his chair. We must also serve as a model. We must show that we care about our poor, and we must demonstrate beyond any doubt that our determination to win our independence is not dictated by Russia, China, or Cuba. We must prove to the world that Panama is a reasonable country, that we stand not against the United States, but for the rights of the poor. He crossed one leg over the other. In order to do that, we need to build up an economic base that is like none in this hemisphere. Electricity, yes. But electricity that reaches the poorest of our poor and is subsidized. The same for transportation and communications, and especially for agriculture. Doing that will take money, your money, the World Bank, and the Inter-American Development Bank. Once again, he leaned forward. His eyes held mine. I understand that your company wants more work, and usually gets it by inflating the size of projects. Wider highways, bigger power plants, deeper harbors. This time is different, though. Give me what's best for my people, and I'll give you all the work you want. What he proposed was totally unexpected. and it both shocked and excited me. It certainly defied all I had learned at Maine. Surely he knew that the foreign aid game was a sham. He had to know. It existed to make him rich and to shackle his country with debt.